So we're reading from Kento 6, chapter 9, verse 28. And since there is no purport, we will also read 29. So which one shall we chant, the Sanskrit? 28 or 29 or 30 or what? Okay. Shisuka Vacha Itita Samaharaja Suranam Upatishtatam Patityam Dishyabhut Avid Sankachaka Gadadara. Shri Sukha Uvacha. Shri Sukadev Goswami said, Iti, thus, Tesham of them, Maharaja, O King, Suranam of the demigods, Upatishtatam, praying, Patityam, yes, Patityam, inside, Dishi, in the direction, Abud, became, Avid, visible, Sankachakra Gadadara, bearing the transcendental weapons, the conch shell, disc, and club. Translation. Sri Sukadev Goswami said, my dear king, when all the demigods offered him their prayers, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Hari, carrying the weapons, his weapons, the conch shell, disc, and club, appeared first within their hearts and then before them. So, and we'll continue reading the next verse. I save myself the Sanskrit and just go to the translation. Surrounding and serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayan, were 16 personal attendants, decorated with ornaments and appearing exactly like him, but without the mark of Sri Vatsa and the Kastuba's jewel. O King, when all the demigods saw the Supreme Lord in that posture, smiling with eyes like the petals of lotuses grown in autumn, they were overwhelmed with happiness and immediately fell down like rods, offering dandavats. Then they slowly rose and pleased the Lord by offering him prayers. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. In Vaikuntha Loka, the Supreme Personality of Godhead has four hands and decorations like the Sri Vatsa mark on his chest and the gem known as Kastuba. These are special indications of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Lord's personal attendants and other devotees in Vaikuntha have the same features except for the Sri Vatsa mark and the Kastuba gem. Okay, so the chapter is called The Appearance of the Demon Vitrasura. So here the demigods, they are in fear of the demon and therefore they are turning to the Lord and they are offering prayers. And in the verse and small purport, you know, we hear how the servants in Vaikuntha, they actually have very similar features like the Lord himself, except a few distinct features which only has the Lord. So we could say, well, this is the power of association, right? That if we associate with a saintly person, we also become saintly. And as we know, the living entity has actually the same qualities, opulences, just like the Lord, just in minute quantity. So by becoming purified, by getting that association, these qualities come out. But I don't really want to make that the theme of the class, actually. even though I felt I had to just at least say something about the purport of the verse. I want to more focus on this eternal battle between the divine and the demoniac. Right? This is accompanying us throughout the whole Bhagavatam. There's always so many scenarios where some demons come and then the demigods feel threatened and they take shelter of the Lord and so this is an ongoing theme, even though of course here in our topic, Vitrasura, as we will hear in the next chapters, he is actually Chitraketu. He is actually a great devotee. He is just externally in this demoniac body. And we did mention very briefly Chitraketu in our false ego seminar because he did not defend when he got cursed. Right? This defending propensity is so strong. But Chitraketu, you know, happily accepted the curse and he was giving this whole eloquent speech. Yes, for a devotee, no difference whether in demoniac situation or in divine body. It's all the same, it's all temporary and. So, and actually the way Vitrasura leaves his body, I find this always such a wonderful example how a devotee is meant to leave this world. You know, we will discover this in the following chapters. It's always my favorite example how he is so, in a determined way, he's doing his duty, fighting against Indra, even though he knows exactly he's going to be killed, but he's looking forward to going back home, back to Godhead. So this is actually a most wonderful example how a devotee should leave this world. But even that, I also don't want to make the main topic. Yeah, so Vitrasura, externally he looks like a demon, but internally he is a devotee. And in the same way, it can also be the other way round, you know, that we externally look like a devotee, but internally we maintain a demoniac tendency there. So, and that ultimately this whole theme of the battle of the divine against the demoniac, ultimately this is all about us, you know, because especially in Kali Yuga, the demon and the devotee, they're in the same body. And even when we hear the story of Hiranyakashipu and Nrisimhadev, often we may think, oh, yeah, thank God, you know, today we don't have these Hiranyakashipus and my God, so terrible demon and so on. But no. First of all, we do have these demons like Hiranyakashipu still present in the world more than ever. They maybe are a little more hidden and polished up and so on. But also we have this demoniac nature in our heart. This is the point. This is why the Bhagavatam is again and again discussing these points, so that we recognize that demoniac nature in our heart. And especially like Hiranyakashipu, I find we can see him really like an embodiment of false ego. You know, he's like the personification of false ego, and how this false ego can drive you to madness, really. And this is also really seen in the world today, that a lot of this crime and violence, this is again another feature of the false ego, trying to be different, be recognized, be, you know, known. You know, this is a well-known fact that a lot of these horrible crimes and shootings, people just somehow want to hit the news, you know, and that's why they perform these things. Yes. And I mean, I don't know how much you're following the current affairs or something. Since the Ukrainian war, I'm looking sometimes on the news websites. Before that, I never even knew what's going on in the world. But, you know, since I'm going regularly to Ukraine and Then people were saying to me a few years ago, what, you're going to Ukraine? There's all war happening, don't you know? So then I started looking at the news. So I'm in this latest thing in New Zealand where this mosque was attacked and 50 people were killed. The guy who did it filmed it and posted it on internet. You know? This is how the ego can drive one insane. You know? That just, oh, look what I'm doing. I'm killing 50 people and everybody should see it, you know. And this is not a rare thing. There's so many incidents like that where people commit terrible violence and crime, killing somebody, and then they film themselves doing it and they post it on the internet. You know, just that fact shows how the ego is the driving force, you know. People run out of ideas how to be different and special and unique and all they can come up with, performing more and more horrific crimes and violence, something that hasn't been there before, you know, just so that everybody knows, you know. Or even, you know, some years ago there was this pilot of the Eurowings flight that crashed the plane into a mountain there in France somewhere, you know. Also, again, just some perverted way, you know, this ego, or I have all these people in my control, their lives is in my hands, and I'm just gonna, you know, fly against the mountain now, and this will really hit the news, and I'm gonna really be known all over the world by performing such a ridiculous thing which hardly has ever been there before, you know. So this is just another feature, how the ego just drives one insane. And Hiranyakashipu definitely also, you know, showed these features. So, but one thing which is interesting, that again and again, even through the Bhagavatam, the demigods turn towards the Lord when some calamity is there. And when there's no calamity, very easily we can almost forget the Lord, you know, and we are all happily enjoying the demigods and their heavenly planets. And same thing is also here for us in this material world. So the calamities, the fears, are what actually makes us more seriously turn towards the Lord. And yes, I mean, it seems like death is really one of the main and foremost, you know, how to say, the main foremost scenarios which makes one turn to the Lord in helplessness, you know. And I remember a couple of years ago, Nirmalaswami was telling this story in a class in the Ukrainian Bhakti Sangam Festival. He was sharing how he did a medical checkup, and then the doctors found something. And they were saying, we have to analyze this. This could very well be cancer. Of course it wasn't. But that's what they said. We better check this out. This actually could be cancer. So, and it took 10 days to get the results of the test. And Maharaj was sharing that, he kind of was laughingly sharing, well, in these 10 days, I probably chanted my best rounds ever, you know. And I was just thinking to myself, just see, you know, even on that level, when death is knocking on our door, you know, that's almost the only incidents which can really shake us up more seriously. And he was sharing how, okay, just the thought, cancer, okay, well, that's it maybe, you know, so wow, it makes a whole paradigm shift there in one's mind, you know. And I mean, as you all know, I experienced that 2 times, you know, in my life, that I was diagnosed with cancer. And wow, so that puts a whole different outlook on life, really, you know. And seems like really only imminent death really has that power to really shake us up, you know. So, and of course, also here in the story, the demigods, they're actually fearing for their life, you know, because this gigantic Vitrasura there appears, and no matter what weapons they're throwing, he just swallows it all. So, okay, well, this looks really serious. This looks life-threatening. So, and then they turn to the Lord and offer prayers and in helplessness. And, of course, prayers actually only have deeper meaning when they're offered in helplessness. In the same way, like during our seminar, we discussed, the question came up, you know, what's the difference between gratitude and glorification? And I was actually a little surprised that such a question comes up, because just the fact that such a question is asked was for me an indication that obviously very often we are offering glorifications we offer glorifications without gratitude. But what's the use of such kind of glorification without gratitude? So the foundation to any, you know, expression of glorification is actually gratitude. Should be, you know. Otherwise, why, you know, expressing one's appreciation and so on, you know, out of gratitude. That should be the motivation. So in the same way, offering prayers, the foundation to prayers should be helplessness, helplessly depending on the Lord, on his devotees. You know, that has to be the foundation. Otherwise, it's just empty words. It's just lip service. It is just shallow. So, and this helplessness is just such an important quality to develop in spiritual practice, actually. It's all about that. Coming to this point of feeling helplessly dependent on Guru, Prabhupada, and Krishna. That's the essence, really, of spiritual life. That's why we also were mentioning in the seminar, Gaugavinda Maharaj says, an ISKCON temple is a crying school where we learn how to cry out to Krishna. You know, so that's really a very nice way of putting things, because this quality of helplessness is such an important quality. And when we open our Vaishnav songbook, almost all the bhajans are expressing this mood of helplessness. Kabe habe bolo, when, oh when, will the day come? Oh Gurudev, kripa bindu dear. Gurudev, give to the servant just one drop of mercy. And then the last line, if you're not merciful unto me, I can only weep, and I will not be able to maintain my life any longer. My God, you know, how much more helplessness can there be than that, you know? And when we look at our Vaishnav bhajans, almost all of them, so almost all of them are expressing this helplessness. So that's how we are meant to approach the Lord. And I do want to share one of my favorite quotes from Prabhupada, 1826, in the chapter where Queen Kunti is praying for the calamities to come in again and again. So there Prabhupada very nicely explains. He says, actually the Lord's holy name has such powerful potency, but there is a quality to such utterance also. It depends on the quality of feeling. A helpless man can feelingly utter the holy name of the Lord Whereas a man who utters the same holy name in great material satisfaction cannot be so sincere. Wow. A materially puffed up person may utter the holy name of the Lord occasionally, but he is incapable of uttering the name in quality. Therefore, the four principles of material advancement, namely high parentage, good wealth, high education, and attractive beauty, are, so to speak, disqualifications for progress on the path of spiritual advancement. So, I mean, this is really one of my favorite purports, because there's so many powerful points in there, you know. First of all, it clearly explains this importance of helplessness. That's how we are meant to call out to Krishna when we chant, you know. And, yes, we know Prabhupada gave us this wonderful analogy of the child crying out in helplessness for his mother. We've heard it all, know it. But no, if we look a little deeper, it's actually so profound, you know, because a child really calling out in desperation and helplessness, the child does not have the problem of a wandering mind. No. The child will not say, oh, this is strange. Every time I'm calling for my mother, you know, I have all these thoughts coming to my mind, who to play with and where and what. And no, there is no room in the child's mind for any kind of other thoughts except, where is my mother? I need her right now. And this is exactly how we are meant to chant. So this also gives a good answer to the question of how to control the mind when we chant. You know, that very often we hear, yes, just when the mind is wandering, just pull back the mind and hear. Yes, all right, pull back the mind and hear. But that's not everything. How long can we do that? That can go on forever. Mind goes, pull it back and hear. Mind goes, pull it back and hear. So this almost can get us to, you know, this battle, you know, some boxing match there with the mind. You know, Satchinanda Swami always says, you know, no need to engage in this boxing match with the mind. That's not going to give the ultimate result. No, the solution is to involve the heart. That's the solution. Like the child crying out in helplessness, in desperation. The child does not have the problem of a wandering mind. So obviously this gives the answer that we also have to involve the heart and chant with desperation, with helplessness. And that will put an end to the wandering mind. Only that, actually. Only that. So, you know, that's why I personally am not so fond of all kinds of other tricks people are giving for chanting, to look at the mantra card or something. You know, this still keeps the whole topic on the level of the mind and intelligence. But no, the real thing is we have to involve the heart when we chant. You know, that there's inattentiveness on the level of the body, mind, and heart. And this inattentiveness on the level of the heart, Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes this as indifference. So this is our problem, that our heart is full of this indifference. You know, that, ah, well, all right, you know, I can take it or leave it type thing, and so, you know, we are not really endeavoring and by involving the heart and really crying out, or when we serve in any other capacities, involving the heart means we do things to our best capacity. We endeavor to our utmost limitations, wanting to please the Lord and the devotees, and we give our everything, our heart and soul. That's attentiveness on the level of the heart. Then there is no indifference there in the heart. Right? But as long as this indifference is there, no matter what we do, in any service or in chanting or even in hearing, if we just sit there and hear, all right, yeah, I should be at the Bhagavatam class and okay, another 15 minutes and then thank God we have prasadam and so on. You know, with that kind of mood of hearing, the heart is not involved. There's indifference there. And it's very simple and logical. You know, the process of devotional service is meant to transform the heart. So in order for it to transform the heart has to be involved. Otherwise, it's going to bypass the heart. And then nothing will happen in the heart. Right? So even hearing words go in one ear out the other ear, they're bypassing the heart. Oh, well, not surprising that even after 40 years of hearing, there's nothing happening in the heart. Because we have not been hearing with an involved heart. And involving the heart, when hearing, for example, means we are hearing with inquisitiveness, with rapt attention, sucking up every word. Okay, what can I get here? Maybe I can capture something. Maybe I can find out how to actually overcome all kinds of impediments in my spiritual practice and. So there has to be some real thirst, longing to find something, you know. So if we hear like that, then the heart is involved, right? So this principle of the heart having to be involved, we find in all levels of service, in all aspects of service. So, and especially in chanting and offering prayers, there has to be that mood of helplessness. You know, and that's why Prabhupada says, yes, you know, a person who is, who utters the same holy name in great material satisfaction cannot be so sincere. Wow, that should be a warning to us. Just see how great material satisfaction is actually so dangerous for spiritual life. You know, because what does great material satisfaction mean? It means, oh, I'm doing all right. Life is not so bad. You know, I've got everything I need. I've got a nice house and a car and a good bank balance. And yeah, everything is really good. So why being so negative about life in this material world? You know, so with great material satisfaction, how can we feel helpless? No chance. Right? So that's why Prabhupada says, you know, a helpless man can feelingly utter the holy name of the Lord, whereas a man who utters the same holy name in great material satisfaction cannot be so sincere. So, I mean, let's understand this deeply, and because, you know, aren't most of us endeavoring for material satisfaction? Let's be honest, we are. You know, as a rule, yeah, we put that as one of the main priorities, our material satisfaction. So, but that's very dangerous actually, because it leads to complacency. That's what it leads to. Oh, yeah. Ah, you know, life is actually pretty nice. And I mean, for me personally, I find it very hard to tolerate these countries where there is such high material satisfaction. I find it really austere to be there because of this complacency. You know, countries like Australia, even though I joined there and I had a great time in the early days there, but my God, I wouldn't want to live there anymore, you know. Because, yeah, you know, Australia is like a heavenly planet. Everything is so beautiful. You've been there, Puruji? Adi Purush Baba, you've been there? Yeah, better don't go there. The whole place is just full of material satisfaction and the nice beaches and palm trees and it's all so beautiful. Everything is so orderly. Even in the cities, there's hardly even any crowds of people or something like in India or Bangladesh or something. You know? No, there's just a few people cruising along and everything is so clean and tidy and my God, you know, you're just drowning in this complacency and material satisfaction. I mean, for me, it's the biggest austerity to be in such an environment because there's just not that urgency there to take shelter. You know, and when you preach to people about the miseries of material life, they say, oh, what are you talking about? You know, life is not so bad. Why being so negative? You know, and all right, death, okay, well, okay. You know, so, not so easy to actually get this across to people that life in the material world means suffering, you know. And I mean, I love these places where, you know, there is a lot of, where there's not much material satisfaction. Favorite places, Bangladesh, Ukraine. Not much material satisfaction. You know, life is, you sit like on a pin cushion, you know, something is always pricking and you can't get comfortable, you know. So they are the best places for spiritual advancement, really, because there is always this impetus there to take shelter, you know. And, I mean, even just some facts prove how Prabhupada's purport is so true, you know. Just, for example, Kiev, capital of Ukraine, Sunday feast, how many people do you get? Around 800 or something, you know. And that's not Hindu crowd or something. It's all local people. Even without a Swami being there, you get about 800 people. So then you go to Berlin, Sunday program. How many people do you get there? Oh, maybe 50 or something. You know, capital of Germany, about 50 people or something. You know, so the figures speak for themselves. You know, the more material satisfaction is there, the more complacent people are. They don't turn towards the Lord. You know, but then in countries like Ukraine, where there's not much material satisfaction at all, you know, there people turn towards the Lord. You know, or the famous Bhakti Sangam festival. You know, you get 8,000 and more devotees to come. So I made a humble attempt to introduce a similar festival in Scandinavia. And we had all kinds of wonderful personalities there, Lokanath Maharaj and Madhava and Dina Bandhu from Vrindavan and you name it. So many wonderful personalities. So Ukraine, 8,000 to 10,000. Scandinavia, you guess. How many people do you get from all the four Scandinavian countries? Huh? What's your guess? Huh? 400. Oh. You're joking. You're dreaming. Huh? No, a bit more than 70. You know, 150 to maximum 200, you know. Yes. Or just last year when I was in Goloka Dham, the devotees were telling Sachinanda Swami and Lokanath Maharaj had some little kirtan mela there. And I was with some Ukrainian girls there visiting. So I was asking, so how many people came? I was curious. Oh, what was the answer? 120 or something? I mean, these Ukrainian girls almost fainted when they heard 120 devotees for Sachinanda Swami and Lokanath Maharaj. My God, you know, in Ukraine you would have 5,000 people coming or more. Whole Ukraine would come. You know? Yes. So these are just some very vivid examples here how true it is that this material satisfaction makes it very hard for us to sincerely turn towards Krishna in helplessness. And I guess that's why Krishna likes to help us to feel helpless. by sending a few calamities every now and again, as he's doing for the demigods. For the demigods, some rich Asura is coming, and he is actually a devotee, but still, you know, they're all panicking, and okay, let's call out to the Lord. So Krishna is doing the same thing for us, you know, sending us all kinds of calamities, and, you know, especially in the form of health crisis, cancer. This is one of his most popular ways, you know, how to shake us up a little bit out of our complacency. So, and the devotee happily embraces these calamities, you know, realizing, oh, Krishna's trying to help me to feel helpless and more tightly take shelter of his lotus feet. You know, so that's the whole deeper meaning of these calamities, or some earthquake, or some tsunami, or a war, or whatever it may be. You know, Krishna has a big a variety there, unlimited varieties of calamities he sends. And even Prabhupada used to always say, yes, when a war comes, then the churches are full. Everybody runs to the church and prays, you know. same principle there, you know. Yeah, so, you know, this is really how the holy name is meant to be chanted, how we are meant to approach the Lord in helplessness. And this is even like that also in kirtan, not only in japa. And I distinctly had that realization some, I don't know how many years ago, when His Holiness Jayapataka Maharaj had his first health crisis there. I was at the time in Bangladesh, and, you know, probably 90% of all devotees in Bangladesh are his disciples. So whole Bangladesh was mortified, you know, at the news that he is unconscious in coma. So, and we immediately started 24-hour kirtans. And these kirtans, they were the best kirtans I've ever heard. Why? Because they were chanted in utter helplessness. Devotees actually were crying out. You know, even kirtan leaders were actually physically crying when they were chanting, really begging Krishna. There was no room to show off. You know, in such situations, when death is approaching, you don't feel like showing off anymore. No, it's too serious. And it was amazing. That's when I realized clearly, wow, even kirtan, we are actually meant to call out in helplessness, you know, and that gives kirtan a whole different quality of kirtan experience, actually. Yes. And then it was interesting to observe, as Maharaj was gradually becoming stable, the helplessness kind of disappeared, faded away, you know, and kirtans went back to normal. So this was very easily I could observe, okay, gradually, people relax. Oh, yeah, looks like it's not so bad after all, and looks like he will stay with us. Okay, we can relax a little bit, you know. And then again, the kirtans lost that intensity and that mood of helplessness, you know. And, yeah, so even in kirtans it is like that. And there is a nice, just to finish off, there is a nice verse from Chaitanya Charitamrita where it says, one is immediately freed from the clutches of Maya if he seriously and sincerely says, my dear Lord Krishna, although I have forgotten you for so many long years in the material world, today I am surrendering unto you. I am your sincere and serious servant. Please engage me in your service. So, and then the next verse says, it is my vow that if one only once seriously surrenders unto me, saying, my dear Lord, from this day on I am yours, and prays to me for courage, I shall immediately award courage to that person, and he will always remain safe from that time on. Which of course doesn't mean that we will not die or something, That doesn't mean we will be safe. No, the highest form of protection is the protection of our remembrance. Remembering Krishna at the moment of death. That's what we should be praying for. Body may be, you know, destroyed or not destroyed, and sooner or later it will be destroyed. So that's a very shallow way of actually praying for protection and thinking oneself to be safe. The real safe, being safe means we remember the Lord at any situation. So in any case, I mean, that's also we can say is the deeper meaning of surrender. That we actually call out in helplessness. Then we surrender. You know? Yes, that's surrendering ourselves, you know, to actually feel that helplessly. That hopeless dependence on Krishna and his devotees. Okay, so 1 minute maybe for a question or comment. Adipurush Prabhu, yes.
Niranjan Swami also says this is his main and favorite technique for method for improving japa is chanting in that exact mood of helplessness as Kunti Devi. In that purport to Kunti Devi's verse. At the same time, we see that in the Bhagavad Gita, repeatedly, and especially in chapter 12, where Krishna describes the qualities of a devotee, Krishna says that a devotee is always satisfied with anything and everything. In the Bhagavatam, in the second, many places.
Even with a calamity.
Yes. So he seemed that a devotee should be satisfied, should be always satisfied in success and failure and satisfied. So if I'm satisfied, how can I be helpless? And if I'm helpless and hopeless, how can I be satisfied? So I personally find it difficult for myself to chant in that helpless mood, even if I'm in some helpless situation. Still, probably my ego is too much, too big for practicing this helpless mode. But it also seems to be a logical contradiction that a devotee is supposed to be satisfied, but at the same time a devotee is supposed to chant in a totally helpless and hopeless, desperate mood. So would you like to shed some light on this?
Well, the way I understand it is that a devotee satisfaction is not a material satisfaction, but it comes from his connection with Krishna, ultimately. And that's why a devotee can be satisfied in any situation, in failure, in success, in happiness, in distress. So that's the whole point, you know, as we surrender and feel that internal dependence, we do Krishna more tangibly manifest himself in our life, and then we feel satisfied even in the biggest calamity, you know? So that's how I understand it.
So how then we feel hopeless?
Hopeless, but helpless.
Okay, helpless.
Devotee is always hopeful. He doesn't feel hopeless. He's hopeful. He always knows. He has that conviction. So if I just continue with the process, sooner or later, it might take many lifetimes, but sooner or later, I will get Krishna's mercy. So devotee is always hopeful.
Helpless. How does one feel helpless? If there's a connection with Krishna, Krishna is my best friend. Why do I feel helpless?
Well, because we realize that you know, we realize our dependence on Krishna. I mean, that's actually what means to be connected, even to Guru, even to Prabhupada. I mean, I hope we are not overemphasizing here Niranjana Swami. It's not meant to be some canvassing or something. But he once gave this very wonderful Vyasa Puja lecture in Magdalenovka, where he explained, he gave that comparison of an electric wire. An electric wire, which has the outside rubber part and the inside copper part. And he said, being connected to Guru, there is these two aspects there, like in the wire. So with a wire, which one is the main one, which transmits the electricity? Obviously the copper part, not the outside rubber part. So, and he compared the outside rubber part with a mere diksha formality. It's also part of it. It also has its purpose. It is also important, just like it is important in the wire. But the real thing which makes the connection is the copper part. And he compared that to that helpless feeling of dependence. You know, so even being connected to Prabhupada, it's not just a matter of mere initiation, and now I'm initiated into the parampara, and now I'm connected with Prabhupada. No, no. Actually connected, being connected with Prabhupada means that deep in the heart we feel helplessly dependent on Prabhupada's mercy, on Prabhupada's guidance, on Prabhupada's instruction, especially on mercy. That's what builds the connection. So we can all even look within our hearts and try and assess ourselves. How much am I connected to Prabhupada? You know, how much actually do I feel Prabhupada being an important personality in my life? How much do I feel helplessly dependent on Prabhupada's mercy? Then we are connected. You know? Yes. And Prabhupada himself demonstrated this, you know, in the famous story where he was chanting there at Advaita Acharya's house, and in this book, our Srila Prabhupada, what's it called? Yes, Srila Prabhupada, our friend to all or something, right, yes. Yeah, so there's this wonderful story how Prabhupada, over so many years, he used to regularly go there and chant in helplessness, crying out, you know, and then one day the pujari asked him, oh, who are you? You've been coming here for so many years. And this was one day before Prabhupada got onto the Jaladuta. He spent the whole day in Advaita Acharya's house praying for mercy, you know. And there Prabhupada, when the pujari is asking him, Prabhupada is saying, yes, my guru has given me this impossible mission. I feel completely unqualified. I don't know how I will, you know, follow this mission and implement it. You know, therefore I'm coming here, you know, or how he sweeps in Radha Damodar temple. In the same book, there's this wonderful story how one neighboring sadhu hears this crying every night, you know, and then one day on the full moon, he goes on the rooftop and looks into the courtyard of Radha Damodar temple, and he sees Prabhupada in the middle of the night at 12 or 1 o'clock sweeping the courtyard, calling out, hey Rupa, hey Sanatan, hey Gurudev, give me your mercy, and. You know, so I mean, my God, you know, that's how Prabhupada prepared himself, crying out in helplessness, you know. But at the same time, Prabhupada was also satisfied in every condition of life, you know. Yeah. And I mean, also this helplessness comes more and more about as the false ego is dissolved, because what makes us so confident here, oh, I can do it all, is basically again the false ego, you know, and as we become purified, the more we realize how tiny and insignificant we are, how strong Maya is, how we can get washed away at any moment, and how we are helplessly dependent on Krishna and his devotees and Guru and, you know, like that. So, I mean, it doesn't contradict itself, you know. Yeah. Often when we hear satisfaction, we may think of material satisfaction, you know, and then it contradicts itself. But if we understand that the satisfaction comes from being connected with Krishna and Guru, then it is a different kind of satisfaction. Okay, I don't want to go too much over time, even though I'm sure there's So many more exciting things to talk about. Okay, well, once again, thank you kindly for allowing me to visit, and I truly enjoyed my time here with in your association, and I always remember Ljubljana as such a vibrant and dynamic yatra. Maybe also because you don't have as much material satisfaction as the more Western world, you know, so it's kind of in between, you know. Yes, and it's good to, good position to be in, not to have too much material satisfaction, really, you know. So Eastern Europe, you can very clearly see there's less material satisfaction, and therefore there's more devotees. And the more west you go, the more the material satisfaction increases, and the less devotees are there, you know. It's a very undeniable fact. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki, Ganta Chimad Bhagavatam ki, Samaveda Bhaktivinoda ki, Guru Premanandi.